Please be seated. So we're running late today, and I'm going to try to keep this short. But I just want to do a little bit of review. As you know, we've undertaken exploration of biblical stories, and as it turned out, although it wasn't our original intention, they have been primarily drawn out of the Hebrew Scriptures, with the exception being the Christmas story and the Easter story. But as a whole congregation, children, youth, and adults, we touched on about six stories from the Hebrew Scriptures. They're just a small handful of the vast number that we could have looked at. But from Genesis, the first creation story, Noah's Ark, Joseph and his brothers, and the Tower of Babel. So four stories from Genesis. From the book of Exodus, the story of Moses. From the book 1 Samuel, the tale of David and Goliath. So our approach has been primarily to treat the biblical stories as potent archetypal myths, rich and colorful in symbol and metaphor, or to see them as literature that, while not factually true, offers insights into human emotion and spiritual searching, growth, and the complexities of relationship. We've looked at the ambiguous and mysterious character of God in these stories, who is both an ally and an antagonist to human beings. Sometimes a magnetic, mysterious, creative power calling human characters to greater possibility and truth. And at other times, cruel, capricious, insecure, and tyrannical. We've raised the notion that the God portrayed in these stories is even capable at times of making devastating and tragic mistakes, and of feeling regret, and of learning. The title and theme with which Megan dubbed the entire year in religious exploration was "The Creator Who Creates Creators," recognizing this ever-changing, unfolding, experimental nature of learning and of choice, and our interconnected, co-creative relationship with the world and with each other and with the great spirit of life. The playful, participatory introductions to each of the stories that Megan and I brought into our intergenerational time were intended, we hoped, to give us more freedom to playfully joust with the stories and the characters and to openly explore their many layers of meaning and to consider the possibility of their enduring relevance to life without requiring any of us to believe or to acquiesce in some way. We've also looked at the reality that the Bible has many authors. Sometimes even within a single story, there can be evidence of a patchwork of versions sewn together with differing situations and concerns of the authors creating inconsistencies in the characters and the plot developments. And I've tried not to deny the troubling and violent aspects of these stories or the discomfort and alienation that they can arouse. At the same time, I hoped and have striven to open up new ways of approaching them and understanding them. A few weeks ago, we explored one of the biggest and most symbolically and psychologically rich stories in the Bible, one of the most consequential stories, the story of the prophet Moses, his origins, his growth into adulthood, and his gradual development out of self-doubt and reticence into a leader with tremendous authority and strength, endurance, and charisma. He accomplishes the great task of his destiny, which is to lead the tribes of Israel out of slavery through a 40-year journey in the wilderness, a wilderness both geographical and spiritual, and into the promised land. But this is accomplished only through great hardship and trial and the bitter choices of a leader burdened with forging a new nation and a new law, under a new law, out of a multitude of landless and undisciplined people. This task is also accomplished at a few key points through some dramatic acts of violence, aggression, and mass slaughter, all of which are portrayed as either divinely ordained, divinely commanded, or at least condoned. So we have the sweet, beautiful story of the baby Moses in the bulrushes, a story often beloved to children. And then we have the very unkid-friendly story of Moses the man ordering the slaughter of various populations, including a large number of his own people at one point because they are not on the side of the Lord, or are seen to be illegitimately inhabiting the lands that have been promised to his people. After preaching on the story of Moses, I was approached by a member of the congregation who, while acknowledging the various nuanced ways that one might interpret the story, nevertheless felt that the issue of violence had not been adequately addressed. And I am truly appreciative of this challenge. This is part of that being a community of dialogue and argument and discussion. And so I wanted to return to it here. The issue that this member raised is echoed by John Collins, the person who wrote the reading that I read earlier. His observation that these scriptural texts describing divinely sanctioned violence have a long, effective history. And by effective history, we mean they've been extremely consequential and influential in human decisions and actions historically. They've been used to justify all manner of injustice, aggression, intolerance, including genocide. The marriage of scriptural authority to political aims, the unholy union of religious, political, and martial power, has left a bloody trail all through human history. And that has to do with not just the Judeo or Christian traditions, but any scripture, any religion can be married to power in a violent way. And as Colin says, this has not yet run its course in human history. The old stories which so often draw uncompromising lines that delineate us from them, you know, these old stories are very clear about who is right and who is wrong, who is with the righteous cause and who is against it, who is good and who is evil, who is within God's law and nature, and who is an abomination, who has the right to live and where, and who is unworthy of rights or even of existence. So these old stories endlessly yield the same devastating results. The question of whether we can really judge through our contemporary ethical lens the morality of ancient peoples is a tricky question. Because the worldview out of which the old stories rose is inconceivably alien to us. So we have to question whether it's appropriate to take our own ethical framework and impose it backwards on the characters in the story, although doubtlessly I am guilty of having done that throughout this year. But that's one problem, is to take our current ethical perspective, project it backwards on to the characters that fill the pages of the Bible. We can, however, grapple with the moral effect of carrying the ancient narratives forward into our contexts, into contemporary situations. It's legitimate for us to judge contemporary situations by contemporary standards and to question whether a biblical worldview is constructive in a contemporary situation. We can see how some of the ancient stories lend themselves to an unending cycle of aggression, oppression, retaliation, and suffering, and that they thwart human well-being and flowering that is possible with peace and human collaboration across difference. Now, human collaboration across difference is a fairly new idea in the world. So given that the biblical stories have had and continue to have this effect, this historical consequence, I feel properly admonished that it's not enough to treat troubling texts in the Bible merely as fiction, as myth, or as allegories. They have to be tackled and judged ethically. And some may not be redeemable on a moral level, no matter how nuanced one's interpretation is. So there is indeed much in the Bible that is not worthy of a God who is worthy of reverence. And there's much that is not worthy of humanity. So the Bible reveals a vivid, unvarnished portrait of human history and human behavior and religious zeal, but this portrait found in Scripture does not always make for a basis of imitation. In his book, The Bible After Babel, John Collins writes this: "It should be clear that ethical principles or theological truth are not simply given by the Bible. Biblical theology and biblical ethics, in short, can never be determined sola scriptura, that is, by appealing only to the text itself, but always have the nature of a dialogue between the Bible as we understand it and whatever other knowledge we may have from other sources." In the reading by John Collins that I shared earlier, he points out that one valid and necessary way of approaching the Bible is by recognizing its great diversity of voices, some of them spiritually luminous, some very dark, and holding that diversity of voices in tension in relationship with each other. So by lifting up certain morally edifying passages and themes that give themselves to peace and social justice and reconciliation, and by giving those emphasis, we also hold the more morally problematic texts in the light of that critique. He also asserts that we must also bring the Bible into dialogue with sources and understandings external to it, that it cannot be understood and cannot be considered morally authoritative in and of itself and outside of a rigorous dialogue. The danger of misapplication comes when the scripture is elevated above that kind of testing. And he gets to the heart of the problem when he says, "People have appealed to the Bible precisely because of its presumed divine authority, which gives an aura of certitude to any position it can be shown to support. The Bible has contributed to violence in the world precisely because it has been taken to confer a degree of certitude that transcends human discussion and argumentation." Certitude that transcends human discussion and argumentation. And that brings me to a perfect point of segue as we move toward the end of our service, which is to recognize people who are joining the church today. What's the connection here? The key to engaging with the Bible on a moral level is the absolute necessity of dialogue between different voices. Differing voices within the vast canon of Scripture itself, different voices between different scholars and students of the Bible, different voices emerging from different points in history, and the dialogue between spiritual seekers such as ourselves who wrestle together in our search for meaning. It is certitude that is the dangerous thing here. The voice or position which assumes its own authority and looks no further than itself, that imagines itself in such possession of the truth that it is above human discussion and argumentation. A voice or position which shuts out alternative perspectives. So our life in Unitarian Universalist community, which holds dialogue and diversity of voices as a primary value, is a beautiful foil for the dangerous illusion of biblical certitude. The conviction of personal conscience, which we also hold to be a primary value, comes out of wrestling, discussion, and testing. It's not the same thing as impenetrable certitude. So we hold as primary values dialogue, but also a kind of certainty of conscience that comes out of testing. And we eventually arrive at clarity within ourselves. So what I want to lift up is the crucial gift that our dialogical way of being in community is for the world that must learn to be peaceful. What we can offer a world that is learning to be peaceful. If violence emerges out of the certitude of one's rightness of position, then we can offer an alternative way of being in which a diversity of perspectives and the capacity and skills of listening and being changed and being mutually penetrated by new insights is a way out of that violence. And so it's a precious and crucial practice that we have in community together. And with that, I want to invite everybody who's going to be new members today. But first I'll invite Posey Walton, who represents our membership committee, and Christina Lentz to join me in our new member recognition.